You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Paul.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
Good, good. Lots going on here in D.C. in the last 2 weeks.
Yeah.
As you probably know, we feel like we're drinking from a fire hose, but we're hanging in.
Yeah. And it sounded like it took a little effort for you to say good, to be honest. I know there are aspects of the world you're not thrilled with. We'll get to all that. Let me introduce it first. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You are Paul Triolo, one of our leading authorities on technology in China. We're lucky to have you at this particular moment. You are a partner for China and technology policy at the consulting group Albright Stonebridge. Is that still accurate?
That's correct. Yes.
And you've got a newsletter called AI Stack Decrypted, pretty new, on Substack. People should subscribe for your insights, right?
Yes, I'm trying to focus sort of narrowly on AI and U.S.-China competition in that arena and all the many, many issues around that we'll talk about.
A lot. So we're going to talk about the so-called AI race between the U.S. and China, whether it should be called that, whether we should encourage thinking about it that way. We'll certainly get into DeepSeek, the now pretty famous Chinese AI that surprised a lot of people with its combination of capability and affordability, and the fact that it's one of the new generation of so-called reasoning models, which have only been with us, at least available for a few months now, the first one having come out from OpenAI. And as most people know, there's a kind of a chip war that the U.S. launched on China. We're trying to restrict their access to advanced microchips and chip-making equipment and so on. So we're going to get into all of this. What do you want to start with, Paul? Do you want to start with, you know, you had a piece in your Substack that first you did a piece on DeepSeek, the reaction to it. Then you had a piece called Update, Sketchy Narratives Around DeepSeek Mount as More Chinese Firms Release Advanced Open Source Models. You want to share a sketchy narrative with us?
Yeah, I think maybe it's better to just first start off sort of explaining the moment here too, because I think the DeepSeek, you know, the attention to DeepSeek came at a certain time here, right? And some of that is critical to understand about the what I've called sort of some of the conspiracy theories. So, you know, this company has been around, as most people now know, under the financial support of this High Flyer Capital Management company, which is a hedge fund in China, has some by some accounts, $8 billion in capital and assets under management. They're not completely unknown, right? They have released models previously. They released a very successful model last summer, the V2 mm-hmm. before V3. And then they released V3 in late December. And that's there were sort of two releases that caught people's attention. The V3 model released in December didn't really draw that much attention, but it included a detailed report about what DeepSeek did to optimize the model and to make it so capable, right? And in that, for example, they claimed that the training run for this model, a single training run had cost something like $6 million. People mistakenly then later, you know, extrapolated that was the full cost of training the model. And in the paper, of course, DeepSeek was very careful to say, well, this doesn't represent the full R&D costs mm-hmm. and other training runs we may have done and other things we did to develop the model. But people sort of focused on that $6 million.
Can I ask you something? So mm-hmm. V3, the model that R1 was based on, was not itself a reasoning model, right?
No, right.
R1 added
just,
the reasoning.
Okay. Right. V3 was just their sort of, think of it like Llama 3 or something, right?
Right.
It was their sort of latest open source model. And again, it's important. We'll get to the importance here. But one of the important things about this is it's open source, right? Because that's a huge topic in terms of the industry, you know, how far behind open source models are from proprietary models from OpenAI and Anthropic.
Can I add one thing? I mean, I gather not only is it open source, which means kind of anybody can copy, can have the model, and lots of people have downloaded it. Microsoft now has it and is offering it and on their on their cloud. And but also a couple of other things. First of all, very liberal license, more liberal than Meta's open source
license.
It's
the MIT license, correct.
And I gather they were more disclosing of the of how they put it together, what the secret sauce was, than even Meta is, right? I mean, first of all, like OpenAI, Anthropic, Google, they're not open source. They're proprietary. They're not telling you what's in the model, and they're certainly not giving you a lot of detail about how they trained it. I gather Meta, it is open source, but it's not as they're not as transparent.
It's really, the term's better term is open weight, right? I mean, the problem is this term open source is not liked by many because it really goes back to sort of open source software like Linux, where the code itself was actually open here. But here, what we're talking about is open weight. So the companies like Meta are releasing the weights of the model and some more detail about
quickly,
the model.
I hate to keep interrupting, but for lay people, if you hear something like this is a 70 billion parameter model as one of the Metas, I mean, there are 70 million like numbers called weights and 70 million interconnections among neurons, and there's a weight for each interconnection, and that's all I'm going to say for now. But it is like, once you've got that, you've kind of got the model. They're giving, you know, this Chinese company is giving the model to the world and giving them, I think, more information about how the model was made than Meta gives. Is that part
true? Correct.
Okay.
Yes, the paper that they published, the paper on V3 that was published in December 27, had a lot of detail about the optimizations they did, and all the things that they innovated, right? And so that drew a lot of attention from some quarters, but it wasn't until they released the R1, the reasoning version of this, in, you know, I think it was less than a week later, a little bit more than a week later, that they released R1. And the time between those was considered very significant, right? Because the as you noted earlier, the release of these reasoning models by in this case OpenAI, it was only the first time was only in September, right? And so for a company like DeepSeek, a Chinese company that was, you know, not unknown but not certainly considered among the leaders in this area, to release a really capable reasoning model so quickly after releasing their sort of base model, if you will, that's what sort of then freaked people out a little bit, right? Then people went back and read the paper and said, oh, $6 million to train the model. And it all happened also critically. It happened around the time of, you know, U.S.-China relations, the Trump transition. And people were thinking, for example, one of the, what I've called a conspiracy theory is, oh, it was timed, you know, to disrupt markets, right? Because obviously what happened is it dropped during Davos. Also, just around the time of Davos, and people started talking about it at Davos. And then when people sort of started to focus on it over the weekend after Davos, Meta sort of freaking out because, you know, started becoming concerned about this, and they set up war rooms. The Information did a story over that weekend. Meta did a war room around this. And then Monday was the day that we got the $1.2 trillion market.
And can you say why Meta was so concerned? Because they wanted to be the king of open source, or what?
No, because this was a challenge to their sort of heretofore undisputed leadership in open source models. And it's complicated too, because they've released Llama 3, which is the one of before this had been one of the highest performing open source model, and R1 then, you know, beat Llama 3 on some benchmarks. But Meta, of course, is also is in the process of determining when to release Llama 4. And so the fact that a Chinese company released this got all this attention. It went to the top of, you know, certain metrics and benchmarks on leaderboards. That created a problem for Meta, in part because of that claim about how cheap it was to train the model. Okay. Now we have to unpack that, because I think that was an overreaction, for example, from both probably from Meta and the market in terms of what this means. Because the big issue here is, what does this mean? The way they did this, how they did it, and we can talk about the disputes over, you know, how much hardware they used to train the model. But this created sort of uncertainty in Meta over what this was, what was going on here. They wanted to understand basically what DeepSeek had done with both V3 and R1 to achieve, you know, seemingly these very effective and efficient and very powerful models that apparently were cheap to also to train, right? Which we need to unpack. So anyway, that sort of freaked people out, and then Monday the market already sort of concerned about valuations and also concerned about things like Stargate, which had just been announced, this huge, you know, $100 to $500 billion AI infrastructure built out by OpenAI.
This was the White House photo op with Sam Altman and the head of SoftBank, and
So the market was already a little bit primed to be concerned about the spend on CapEx on large, you know, data centers and AI data centers. So anyway, that one of the conspiracy theories then was they had deliberately timed this somehow to crash the market, and that also that the hedge fund had shorted NVIDIA, which again, I think these are the kinds of conspiracy theories that not surprisingly are out there. I think they're complete, you know, they're bunk because once you understand what the company's sort of, you know, goal is and what the company is, then these don't make as much sense. But anyway, so the timing of this was all important. And then the other thing, as I've noted, is that we're at a really critical inflection point where these models are becoming really capable, right? And so there's growing concern about releasing more and more powerful models, right? So there's sort of a national security concern that's becoming more apparent. And then it's also tricky for companies to release these very powerful models, because then if they become very popular, the inference costs go really high, right?
We should distinguish here another little explainer point. Inference refers to like using the part where you're using the computer. You ask it a question, spits out an answer. The compute that's consumed in the course of inference is inference compute. What you normally hear about when you hear about these huge costs and all the huge chips needed is the training. And one reason the market, NVIDIA stock crashed, is because people thought, well, you're not going to need if this was trained so cheaply and with so few chips, you're not going to need so much for training. And then some people said, well, you're still going to need a ton for inference, because these reasoning models inherently consume a lot more at the inference end than the pre-reasoning models. Okay.
Right. And also we're at a point, where in the general industry, we're moving from this emphasis on training and the expenditure of money on training, say 80 to 20 right now, the compute, right? Because a lot of companies are training up these models using a lot of compute. But eventually, as the models become deployed and widely used in enterprises, I use like 4 models every day, right, to do all sorts of things. So as that becomes, you know, the focus of company deployment over the next 2 to 3 to 5 years, that's going to flip. The training is going to go, it's going to, from 80-20 training, it's going to go 80-20 inference, right? And so you need a lot of compute out there to sort of serve up these, you know, the apps that the enterprises and individuals are using. So that's also a really important point, because it is, in addition to the alleged training being low, some of the innovations that DeepSeek did relate to doing cheaper inference. And everybody sort of, that's what people love and why open, and it's also open sourced. And so the idea is you're going to have to drive down the costs of inference for this to be widely used and used in companies and by individuals. Those costs to serve up these apps are going to have to go down.
So all told,
one argument is that this makes it more likely and more necessary to have build these data centers, because a lot of that compute is going to be used for inference.
So do you think all told the market did massively overreact? I mean, should NVIDIA stock in theory have dropped at least somewhat in light of what you now believe to be the case about all of this?
No, I don't really think so, because I think that people, it's complicated, because people are still, there's still some skepticism in the market about, the use cases and the sort of business models and how companies that are expending these large quantities on infrastructure are going to recoup those investments. And so the challenge is also, if the cost of the model is cheaper, for example, and here it's important to note the difference, for example, between, you know, the app on your phone, the consumers are using and paying, say, a monthly fee for, and where a lot of the money is access to the API, the application programming interface in the cloud. So, for example, OpenAI makes a lot of its money by renting out the API, right? Charging for the API, they also charge on the phone for home use. I'm paying $200 a month, for example, for Pro mode for ChatGPT. So there's different revenue streams, and Anthropic, for example, doesn't have an app. They don't put as much emphasis on the app for consumers. They make a lot of money from companies.
They finally, it took them forever to get an app. They finally have an app on the Android phone. It took them forever, but don't get me started complaining about tech companies. Let me ask you a background question. because it really does. I haven't heard this addressed, and it matters a lot. And it's like, what should we assume about the relationship of Chinese tech companies to the government? Right. When DeepSeek came out, some people were, in fact, many of the theories that you talked about, oh, they timed it to do this, they timed it to do right. that, were some of them are based on the premise that this is the government, this is the Chinese government talking. Now, I've always assumed that there's a tendency to overstate, or at least to readily assume, a tight connection between companies and Chinese government. On the other hand, I speculated in some podcast right after this happened that I would guess that the company wouldn't have released all the secret ingredients of how they did this without some sense that that was okay with the government. I mean, this is a pretty significant act on their part. You know, you're in effect, China is giving us the most, in a certain sense, the most advanced knowledge in the entire country about how to build a state-of-the-art AI. I would think that the company at least might clear that with Beijing. But you tell me, what should we assume and what do we know in this case and so on about these relationships?
Great question. So look, some of the people claiming that this was some sort of, you know, orchestration, orchestrated by the Chinese government. I think the best one was Paul Merlucky of Anduril said it was a Chinese psyop. and I sort of termed that a little bit ludicrous in my Substack, because, you know, I mean, come on.
We should say Anduril is a defense contractor in effect.
Right. So there are many companies now that sort of benefit from this, you know, China AI threat meme, or, you know, China is an mm-hmm. existential threat. And so there, you know, you have to just keep that in mind when you're listening to those kinds of comments. But it's a good question. And so there's a couple things. One is that people drew some parallels to the Huawei release in August of 2023 of their Mate 60 smartphone when Secretary Gina Raimondo from the Commerce Department, former Secretary Raimondo, was in Beijing. And so the idea there was that was an attempt to embarrass her, right? Because Huawei had managed finally to produce advanced semiconductors, despite U.S. export controls, that they were using in this phone. Now, there, I talked to a lot of people about that. And my sense was that, yes, the Chinese government may have suggested to Huawei or you know, put strong pressure on Huawei to release that during her visit to embarrass her, right? But that's a very different thing than what's being alleged here, which is that this was released deliberately to, you know, to crash the market, or to, you know, to show the, you know, to embarrass the new Trump administration. I'm not buying that. And there's no evidence, again, that this company involved here, DeepSeek, it's a small company staffed with many young, very young engineers, you know, sort of, it's almost like a science project on steroids. Mm-hmm. where they have this hedge fund backer, and he's saying, hey, let's go and figure out how to do AI within the limitations that we have in China in terms of the hardware access, which we need to get to. And, you know, they talk more about pursuing artificial general intelligence, or pursuing advanced AI, sort of like OpenAI at the beginning, mm-hmm. right, where they weren't really a for-profit company. They were doing research on how to build models better, and that's what this company, at least initially, has focused on. And there's no evidence that the Chinese government, you know, ordered them to do anything here, as probably yeah. happened in the case with Huawei
In fact, it's not obvious that you would expect the Chinese government to encourage, again, release of, well, either an open weights model itself, in a sense, or certainly the secret sauce as to how they made it, and yet they did. And I actually came up with a little theory about if it was with the government support they did this, what they might be up to. But first tell me, do you think they did clear this with the government?
I don't think so. My view is that the bureaucrats in Beijing were just as surprised mm-hmm. as, you know, the bureaucrats in D.C. and as Wall Street was. Because you have to remember, this company, this wasn't the first time they did this. They released a very mm-hmm. capable model last summer in May. Just before the summer, version 2, right? And again, they're in a very competitive market in China, a very competitive you know, the open source side of the house, for example, in China is becoming more competitive. So it's not surprising that 7 months after they released their first, their last model, V2, they decided to release V3, because there's Chinese companies, like in the US, are now, you know, releasing models to sort of show whose model is better. They're running them against benchmarks, and they're saying, oh, we're number one on the leaderboard now. You know, it's a very competitive thing. And also, the Chinese New Year, all this was coming before the Chinese New Year. And so I think one of the motivations was to get this out before the Chinese New Year. You're going to have a long period here. And in fact, a lot of the other Chinese companies like Alibaba and others, Minimax, Moonshot, have released new versions of their models, Tencent, during this time frame. Now, were they reacting to DeepSeek? You know, there's some of that. There's probably some competition there. But I have a hard time believing that the Chinese government said, you know, go release this now at this time. It doesn't really make sense. Now, the CEO of the company, Liang Wenfeng, he was then interestingly summoned, you know, after this whole thing.
I heard that.
A really classic photo of him. He looks like he's 16 years old, sitting in this room with the doily chairs, you know, listening to the premier Li Qiang talk about, you know, his work report. And then
so he's the head of government, even though she is
he's the prime minister, the government, and then she is really the party secretary and uses right. this title he's president, but really he's dog. The party okay. leader. To me that was like significant, but it was after all this had become so prominent and DeepSeek had gotten such all this recognition. So
and there's they no did that evidence
between
like,
last summer
like,
and now that the Chinese government took an interest in this company, right? There's no evidence that I've seen.
And this was a public event, like the head of the government was kind of proud to be seen with this guy. This guy is like a Chinese. Yeah. And they're like proud.
Yeah, they're,
and
you know, this is a...
I had heard that like open source work in general has for some time been kind of a source of pride among like Chinese computer scientists who felt they weren't getting enough respect in the world, and participating in open source stuff broadly, even beyond AI, was a way that they could show that, you know, we're world class, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what this company was about, right? This company it's interesting because they really, until even more recently, the fact that they didn't really have a business model, right? I mean, they weren't really trying to directly compete, for example, with Llama 3 and Meta or with OpenAI in terms of what those companies are doing more broadly, right? Where those companies are supporting lots and lots of companies, thousands of companies. You know, the model is you lease out your API and then you work with those companies to help them develop applications internally, right? And that's a big big business model. But you have to have lots of people. This is a company of 100 people. They're all mostly, you know, hardware and software engineers, very young. And so this company doesn't have this huge, you know, the business model to sort of dominate the AI sector like the big US companies. So yeah, their focus is on open source and sort of the science, if you will. And if you look at what they did in getting these models efficient and innovating on low-level hardware programming to make GPUs, you know, talk more better to each other under the limitations they're under, you know, that's what they were focused on, right? So the idea that there's some sort of political psyop, for example, is really, to me, you know,
So if we assume they didn't, the company didn't clear this with the government, do you think the government is a little upset? Because, I mean, it does seem kind of weird, given the fact that we have basically more or less declared that there's an AI war on. I mean, that's our policy. We're trying to cut off their chips. We're trying to cut off their equipment. Our big model makers are proprietary. The head of one of the big proprietary companies, Dario Amadai, just came out with this. I'm sure you read this thing where he said, look, the goal is for the West to dominate China forever. I mean, he virtually said that, right? It's like, we have to get to AI first. Now, strictly speaking, he said, we have to use AI as our asset and freeze other nations out unless they participate in our kind of democratization process. And I don't think China is going to, you know. Well, so anyway, it's pretty severe.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. The Anthropic and OpenAI, of course, the backdrop here is that as these models have become more and more advanced, they've drawn more attention from the U.S. government, right? And so companies like OpenAI and Anthropic are working with the U.S. government, around safety and sort of, you know, how to test these models to make sure they can't be used for nefarious purposes. Because that's the other big backdrop here, is that the models now are capable, and companies are putting in place, for example, internal controls about how do you, you know, if the model reaches a certain capability, how do you test it and make sure you've built in safeguards so that the model doesn't, you know, spit out the formula for a biological weapon that somebody could use, right? Mm-hmm. This is a huge issue. It's going to be discussed next week in Paris at the Paris AI Action Summit. I will be there. We're actually sponsoring a panel with Meta and Anthropic and AWS, who all have these responsible AI scaling, what they call AI scaling policies internally, to say, okay, when the model reaches a certain capability, and it's really complicated to determine that threshold, then the company needs to be careful and do additional testing and have additional policies in terms of release of that model. So that's also happening here, right, is that there's growing concern about the capability of these models and how they could be misused. So that has to be understood as part of the situation.
And I kind of sidetracked this by getting into Anthropic, although all that is interesting. I'm glad you'll be at the summit. I gather this is the follow-up on the original summit at Bletchley Park, if that's how you pronounce it.
Correct.
Where I think Alan Turing did his code breaking. Is that
where the Enigma code was broken during World War II, that was critical to the Allied victory over Germany, right? They broke the Enigma code.
And this series of computer
really was born, right?
Truly. And a lot of fundamental principles were laid down by Turing. And this series of summits, I think, is the closest thing we have to what could become a kind of a skeleton for global governance.
Correct.
AI. We're nowhere near there yet. And of course, we don't have a U.S. President enthusiastic about the concept of global governance. Biden, I wouldn't have bet on to advance it very far. But in any event, if you agree with some of us that we need some degree of international rules of the road for AI, this thing you're going to be at is the thing to watch. This thing's going to be in Paris. Now, back to what I was going to say was, so we have more or less said, yes, this is an AI war. I mean, I know Amodai doesn't speak for the government, but there's just this vibe everywhere. And we are doing these restrictions. So, and it would seem kind of surprising if China, having, in spite of these restrictions, come up with this model that's competitive with ours in ways that surprise some Americans. Even the tech people can't figure out exactly what's up. It just seems kind of surprising that China would not only make it open source, like here's the weights, but say, oh, and here's how we did it, right? I mean, so the question is, do you think the government's really happy that it just seems strange that would happen with government approval, which you think it didn't with explicit approval, but it seems strange that the government would necessarily be delighted about that, right?
Well, it's interesting because the government in China is eager for Chinese companies to be competitive, right, in this field. They feel like, you know, absent the export controls, that there are less barriers to entry here, right? And if you have a lot of smart STEM students and you have a lot of smart people, you can develop these models. So China, for example, has taken a deliberately sort of hands-off, the light touch on regulation, because they don't want to over-regulate and then, you know, sort of stifle innovation. So the government, I think, is eager to support the industry. And so therefore, that's why I think, again, that this was not something that really required government approval. The other piece is open source, right? Open source is a complicated thing, right? So the U.S. government, for example, is also has decided in the new AI diffusion rule, which they released in January, which we should talk about, that they deliberately said the U.S. government is not controlling open source models or open weight models, right? They said we're not going to control these. We're going to try to put controls on the weights of proprietary models and their export around the world. So open source is sort of this arena, which is a little more freewheeling. It's global. Chinese government, for example, has not blocked access to some of the open source hosting sites like Hugging Face and GitHub. There's some complications around that. There are subtle things where the Chinese government has occasionally blocked access to those sites for very specific things. But generally, the Chinese government appears to support the idea of open source. And they're looking at open source approaches in other areas like semiconductors. The RISC-V Foundation is really big in open source. So the Chinese government is generally supportive of the open source concept. But the challenge has been that up until now, the difference between the proprietary model capability and the open source has been people are thinking, well, there's still a year and a half, 2 year difference. And so that's why one of the reasons the US government has said, we're not going to control open source models. We're going to only control the most advanced models. But now DeepSeek sort of throws into question that approach because, you know, okay, maybe Chinese models are not that far behind the open source models. So that's certainly at play here. But I don't really think the Chinese government would want to step in and tell a company like DeepSeek, you can't open source that model, because they want their companies to participate in these types of international, this is essentially international collaboration, right? I mean, the fascinating thing is that all these companies now are hosting DeepSeek, you know, Microsoft, Azure, AWS, all these companies that normally host open source models are all hosting DeepSeek, right? A Chinese open source model, which is a good thing.
A little bit, and surprised me, but it happened fast. Is there a little bit of an analogy?
One quick example, Yann LeCun, who is the chief scientist at Meta and a big proponent of open source software, he was very effusive in his praise for DeepSeek. He said, hey, this is great. You know, even though they built on other existing approaches to model development, they innovated, and then they gave back to the open source community. And he says, you know, this is a good thing. So the industry in general is also split between sort of the open source proponents like Meta and IBM in the US. There's a consortium pushing open source. And then, of course, the proprietary models that OpenAI and particularly Anthropic and others.
And Mark Andreessen of Andreessen Horowitz is pro open source, although he's also very inclined to use the AI war with China meme when it's useful. But he was very welcoming of the model. But then he turned around and said, and this just shows we got to get busy. And, you know, we should say, of course, the virtue of the AI war with China narrative. You alluded to this, but to be explicit, there are at least two virtues, okay? American companies can use it to fight off government regulation, which will hobble us in this existential race with China, and to get government subsidy for things like power projects and so on. So it's perfect for them. I personally don't think that's motivation so much. But there are definitely people like Altman who didn't used to sound like China hawks who suddenly do.
Right. And it's important to note that there's not sort of unanimity here amongst the U.S. tech community on this. Right. So if you notice, you know, OpenAI, Anthropic have made more comments supportive of U.S. export controls and that kind of thing. Right. But then, you know, Google and other companies and NVIDIA, of course, and others are being careful about this. I mean, companies are in a difficult place here. Right. Because most companies will say, yes, and national security issues are important. But then I think there's been a lot of disagreement over some of the efforts the U.S. government has taken on export controls, which we've talked about. And then like this AI diffusion rule got a lot of pushback from Oracle in particular and other players in the industry who are saying, wow, the U.S. government wants to control, you know, where AI is developed globally. And that's going to be very disruptive to supply chains, et cetera, et cetera. So one of the interesting reactions then to this whole thing was, you know, are the export controls effective or not? Which I think we should probe into a little bit because
One more question about open source. Is there a little bit of an analogy like Meta is to the proprietary companies, Google, OpenAI, Anthropic, as China is to the US, in the sense that I gather part of Meta's motivation for going open source is like, okay, then we're not going to make money off of this in the way that like OpenAI wants to make money. It's not a proprietary model. We're giving it away. Fine. But this does mean, you know, to the extent that we push it out there and that leads to more innovation. And so you really always have a good open source model out there. At least we won't get frozen out by the proprietary companies. And after all, Meta has these platforms they can use to distribute AI. So as long as they have access to an AI that's more or less as good as Frontier, as long as they don't get frozen out by the proprietary companies, they've kind of got all they need. First of all, I'm not even sure that was their logic. That is speculation. But if it was, is that is would China kind of think of the U.S. the same way? It's like, let's get our let's invest our expertise and genius into the open source movement. And then a thousand flowers will bloom. There will be further innovation. We will have access to it. And the U.S. will not have these models that are vastly superior to what we have. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, keep in mind that the reason a company like Meta does this is their business model is still working with companies to develop applications based on their models, right? So the idea is by releasing this open source, it's going to be the developer community is going to grow.
So they do want it to be a platform for AI wrappers or apps.
Remember, if you think of open source Linux, right? So Linux was open source; it's free, and Microsoft, the proprietary software was the alternative. But companies like Red Hat, for example, developed a business model around providing support for enterprises to deploy Linux at scale in enterprises. Mm-hmm. And so it was, and then they were bought by IBM, right? So a really good business model.
Meta has a Llama API that they make money off of.
Yes, absolutely.
But see, that's partly because their licensing is so strict. They won't let other big companies use Llama, right? Whereas the Chinese are letting anybody use it pretty much.
Yeah, at this point, that's what it looks like, right? That the MIT MIT license is a little more liberal, right? And it's already being hosted by hundreds and hundreds of services in the U.S. And then, of course, the app which I have on my phone has been downloaded by millions of people, which is interesting because also, as remember, the context of this happened in January, where the U.S. government divestiture law on TikTok meant that Google and Apple decided to comply, at least for the moment, with pulling TikTok out of their stores. The user information for TikTok users, the U.S. information is stored in Oracle servers in Texas in a secure enclave. And now, all of a sudden, we're in Apple stores and Google stores. We have a Chinese AI app where if you're using it, in some cases, it depends on how you're using it, how you're hosting it. The data that you're in, the queries you're putting in are going back to servers in China, right? So anyway, that was another sort of irony of the whole thing, which is that I think what happened is, nobody really anticipated this happening. Like what if a Chinese company releases a really capable open source model and everybody starts using it? And so I think a lot of heads exploded in Washington when this happened, and they're still trying to figure out, like, what do we do about it? Do we tighten export controls, or do we, do we stop exports of NVIDIA's H20 GPU, which we can talk about, or do we try to ban the DeepSeek from app stores in the U.S.? It's really complicated because it would mean sort of going after open source software in a way that the U.S. government has avoided doing. For example, with RISC-V, even though China's using that, the U.S. government has been reluctant to sort of take on the open source community by trying to restrict, the ability of companies to collaborate on open source. And it's a tricky thing because that's why, for example, the RISC-V Foundation moved to Switzerland because they didn't want to be subject to export controls, for example, on open source related technology. So this highlights the open source piece of it is interesting, but it also is amazing when you think about it that suddenly this Chinese AI app is all over phones, PCs, and servers in the U.S.
It is. Really an and of course, thing. In addition to the app downloads, more than 100,000 versions of the model have been downloaded, and those can be used in principle in insulation from, the data doesn't go back to China, right?
Correct.
And so
Perplexity is using it, for example. Perplexity is a great search engine is using it as one of its options. And they're very clear to say, we're hosting this here and there's no link.
Same with Microsoft's version and so on.
Right.
So you want to talk, so the diffusion rules are separate. It was like a parting shot from Biden on his way out the door. He laid down this whole new policy separate from the chip restrictions on just China, which basically divides the world into three categories, good guys, small number of nations, not even all of NATO quite, I think. And
Poland and Israel didn't get into the tier one.
Yeah.
They were mad about that. Right.
Bad guys like North Korea, China, Russia, Iran, and I guess some others. And then everyone else. And we managed to piss off almost the whole world because there are restrictions on everyone who's not a good guy. And there's only 16 good guys or something.
Right. The tier two countries. So yes, let's think of it as tier one, tier two, tier three. Yeah. Tier one is the good guys. Tier three is the bad guys. Tier two, the countries in that tier have some restrictions. So there's caps on compute, and then they have to jump through some hoops to show like KYC, like who their customers are, and you know, keep track of the numbers of GPUs that are around. So yeah, it's a very sort of complicated and aggressive rule, which is an attempt to give the US government basically, you know, veto power over where AI deployments of infrastructure are globally. And so, yes, it's a very unusual approach. And, you know, with the goal of sort of preventing, you know, Chinese researchers on AI from accessing restricted hardware anywhere in the world. And part of that is because it turns out that, you know, in addition to the semiconductors that you've noted have been the focus of control, semiconductors and manufacturing equipment for semiconductors that have been a huge issue over the last 2 years, it turns out that the sort of systems level architecture of GPUs, for example, integrated into servers, is very complicated. They're all over the place, right? They're all over the world. The big cloud providers, for example, provide APIs where you can access, you know, hardware that may be restricted. And then there are many, many, many small companies that that rent out their GPUs for people to use around the world. And so so the US government and the people who are pushing this meme that AI, again, we haven't even said that, you know, what is the reason for all this? The reason for the US controls is this idea that whoever gets to artificial general intelligence or artificial superintelligence wins and everybody else loses, right? It's sort of a zero sum game, which I and many others who know the industry pretty well disagree with, right? Even Jan LeCun is like that. He says, you know, this is an iterative process. And it's not like, you know, we're suddenly going to wake up one morning and, you know, the US or China has won the AI race, right? I mean, that's not really the way the technology works.
Now, is the reason
that's driving this effort, though.
So are you taking issue with this idea that's not uncommon in Silicon Valley? I think you see it in Nick Bostrom's 2014 book, Superintelligence. I think you saw it in this influential, for better or worse, paper, Situational Awareness, that once you get to AGI, everything does change. In this model, once you get an AI that is, you know, well, people define artificial general intelligence generally, but once you get an AI that's about as smart as a person, and moreover, the expectation is that at that point, you're building AIs that are really accelerating the development of more AIs. You're getting this positive feedback.
And so they see
this rapid takeoff. Like, you get to human level intelligence, and like a nanosecond later, you're at super intelligence. And if China is like just below AGI or even, you know, at it, and we're at super intelligence, we can have our way with them. Isn't that kind of the idea that a lot of people have in mind?
Yeah, but I think it's a false.
Okay, that's what you take issue with.
Yeah, I take issue with that.
Rapid takeoff at AGI.
I've heard directly from U.S. government officials and advisors to the U.S. government that yes, that all the major AI labs, for example, are developing virtual software engineers. Right. So, and within 1 to 2 years, even sooner. And as you look at some of the coding, of course, benchmarks and how some of these models are performing on the specific coding benchmarks, they're getting really good, right? So the latest, I think it was latest, was it Meta, the Llama model, or one? No, maybe it was OpenAI. They ranked at the model ranked as 175th best programmer in the world, right? And they went from like 1,000 to 175 really fast, right? Within a matter of months. So the capability of the models to do coding is exponentially is growing very fast. So the idea is that instead of having 100 software engineers to throw at a problem, now you'll have 1 million. You know, you can deploy 1 million virtual engineers. So yes, therefore the takeoff.
And what do you say to that? It does sound like there would be an accelerating effect.
Well, again, all of this process is going to be under control of it's not like it's still hard. It takes a lot of effort, and it's still not clear what the gains will be and how those gains will be deployed, right? I mean, that's still within the control of the companies and the people who are developing these models. I think the other factor, though, is that we're also in the at the cusp in 2025 of things like agentic AI, right? Where these models are going to be lashed into systems where they're going out and doing things on your behalf, right? They're looking at websites and filling out forms. If you listen to Dario and some of the OpenAI product managers at Davos, they were talking about agentic AI and how this, you know, this is sort of the
OpenAI just released, you know, somewhat primitive, but you know, this thing called Operator.
Right. And yeah. It's going to be able to go out and, you know, make reservations for you, and you couple that with a reasoning model where you can say, you know, make me travel arrangements, you know, to go to France to cycle for 2 weeks, and you're going to get, you know, you're going to have the agent will have the ability to do to operate on your behalf. Now, it's complicated because there's lots of regulatory issues around that. What sort of agency you give an agentic model, and you know, and how does it pay for things? That's where there's a lot of talk about, you know, the integration of crypto and blockchain and AI that we're probably on the cusp of too. So anyway, so you throw all that together, and then you throw together the idea that we're going to have, you know, super software engineers that are going to drive these models to be even better, and then you get this idea that somebody is going to get there first, and then they're going to dominate the other side. But again, I don't think it's not going to be this black and white thing. Both sides are going to make progress. We're trying to slow China down so we get there first. But again, the there's another way to look. So the one conclusion is, well, if the U.S. and China are, you know, on the opposite sides geopolitically, then yes, of course, we want to do this. The other way to look at it, which I prefer, and I've written an article with Alvin Graylin, who's a great, you know, sort of Web3 futurist on this, is, look, if this is really, if you believe this, then there's two things that you should be concerned about. One is, if China is going to be pursuing these things, and DeepSeek is a good example of this, like, wow, where did the DeepSeek come from? Shouldn't we be thinking about the two big countries, the two biggest countries that are pursuing development of AI at scale? Shouldn't we figure out a way to regulate AI to prevent, you know, malicious actors from getting a hold of this? Because as these models become more capable, they're going to fall into the hands of people who can do all sorts of bad things. And if only, you know, if there's no global agreement on this, and the U.S. and China are at odds, we're never going to get to that world, and that's a dangerous world. Where
I absolutely agree. No, I mean, right? I think if you take,
and that alone should be what, in my view, what DeepSeek highlights, the reaction should be not more export controls, but like, oh my God, how do we actually collaborate and figure out how to control the technology and the worst aspects of it?
And I think that logic is stronger if you anticipate rapid takeoff at AGI, because it's going to be so destabilizing. And by the way, the country that is, quote, lucky enough to get to take off first, if indeed it happens, may be the country that just gets radically destabilized internally and falls apart. I mean, there's so many dramatic effects this can have at the economic and social and cultural and personal level. Ilya Sutskever said something in a TED talk. He's, of course, one of the main AI geniuses. He said, you know, I, my hope is that people will recognize, will on the one hand, you know, see the wonder of this all, but on the other hand, recognize that enough trepidation is in order, that we need to all get together, everyone on the planet, and deal with what could have devastating impact on the whole species if we're not careful. And you don't even have to buy the sci-fi takeover scenarios. Although I can't find a way to totally rule those out, the fact is, it's just, this is going to be, you know, fast and powerful and out of control, and we don't know what's going to happen, and we should give, you know,
I think when I think of DeepSeek, to me, that it's sort of almost blaringly obvious that this is an example of why we would want to have collaboration on this issue, and not you know, this sort of bifurcated world where, you know, China runs off in this direction and the U.S. runs off in this direction. And the other thing is also that if it is the U.S.'s stated goal of preventing China from doing this and rushing headlong to do this, you know, how should China view this, right? And then the issue also that I've raised before, I think we raised it on the last time I was talking to you, is a lot of the hardware base for all this happens to be sitting 100 miles off the coast of China in a territory that China considers part of China. And so if the U.S. is saying, you know, we're gonna use these GPUs manufactured by NVIDIA, TSMC, and we're going to race off and we're going to get this AI first to beat China.
Right.
And then we're going to dominate China's, you know, militarily and economically and technologically and socially. I mean, you know, that again is another hugely destabilizing, you know, factor.
Yeah, because in this whole thing. I mean, right? As naive we to said, think that
China's just going to sit there and say, oh, that's fine. You know, I mean, that's what people seem to think.
I mean, as we said, but we should repeat because so few people say it. The fact that China was getting these high-end chips from those factories had been a deterrent to invade, because the factories will almost certainly one way or another get enduringly disabled via war, especially if it looks like China's going to win it. That alone should make you wonder about the wisdom of chip controls. But you're right. Then if you turn around and say, by the way, there, you know, the advanced chips are still flowing to us from these factories, and you know what? We're going to use them to dominate you, which is right, what Dario right. Amodei said. Okay.
Right. Exactly.
And
to me, that sort of blows my mind that people think, the people who repeat that, you know, and sort of say, well, the response to DeepSeek should be to double down on export controls. I'm like, you know, really? I mean, is that the best way to, you know, you're sort of buying into this idea that sort of zero sum game is a good thing, and not only that somehow, you know, China is going to sort of we're going to take this while the U.S. you know runs ahead and gets the ASI, and we're going to and dominates us, and you know, and we're going to sort of take it without reacting. Right? So yeah, I mean, I'm sort of astounded because the reaction to DeepSeek sort of highlighted this division, right? So the on mm-hmm. the one hand, you have the open source community. You had Yann LeCun, you even had NVIDIA, you had Pat Gelsinger, you know, the CEO of Intel. You had a lot of technology leaders sort of welcoming this. This was a good idea, right? This is a good thing. It's right. sort of China is now, you know, contributing to the open source. And then you had this almost, you know, opposite reaction, which was, oh my God, you know, China has skirted the export controls, developed these advanced models, and therefore what we need to do is do more export controls and double down mm-hmm. on this. And then, you know, Josh Hawley proposed this bill last week, which was like to decouple the AI sectors, right? I think he was proposing like a fine and jail time for anybody who downloaded DeepSeek, right? And I was like, are you effing kidding me here? I mean, this is the reaction to this, right? I mean, I don't know who's giving him his talking points on this or where he's getting his information, but that struck me as like, you know, that's like the most crazy reaction to this, right? Of all the reactions.
See, this is why on a podcast I did about a week ago, when I was speculating about why if DeepSeek did release all the stuff with the government's approval, like what message would the government be sending? And I know you now say that's probably not a valid premise. It probably wasn't the government saying anything at all. But I said, it could be like a kind of peace offering. Like they're saying, look, obviously, you know, if you want to have this big AI race, it's not an obvious win for you. And there's another way we can do this, right? Like just get collaborative, share stuff, and, you know, because that would have made sense. As a rational country might have received the message that way. Sadly, we seem not to live in one. Right. But
and also the implication of what the U.S. system is saying, if it's going to double down all these things, is basically we want to all, you know, that AI is going to bring all these benefits, you know, healthcare, drug discovery, all these things. That we're essentially happy to deny China the most, you know, the best part of those benefits because we want to mm-hmm. dominate China technologically and militarily. So we're also willing to sort of, you know, to try to control technology to prevent China from developing those other capabilities. Yeah. And again, as I think I've said before on this and other podcasts, you know, the vast majority of the use cases of these models right now is, you know, civilian, you know, it's productivity, it's drug uh-huh. discovery, it's, you know, it's things that are not military, right? And so we're the U.S. government is essentially saying, well, in the future there's going to be this conflict with China, there's going to be military advantage to be had if we dominate AI and they have less capable AI, and so we're going to focus our policy now on this potential for future conflict and the potential that China could have better AI than we do in that future conflict, and predicate mm-hmm. the sort of current, the export controls and all this on that also, right? In addition to the other things we've talked about. So to me, that's sort of, you know, there's a bigger moral issue there, which is, you know, wow, that's a big deal. You're essentially saying we want to control China's development and restrict it, its economic and social and technological development, because we insist on maintaining this idea that we need to be dominant in this technology. So we're gonna not only control AI and GPUs, we're gonna control like a company in China that develops process gases for semiconductor production, right? That's what the export control package in December that was released, went way back down in China's supply chain in the semiconductor industry, for example, which we should talk about a little bit too, because I think the other part here is the hardware base is really important. And when people say, for example, the export controls didn't work in this case with DeepSeek, that's not really accurate. I don't really agree with that. They worked, but they forced, the real issue is whether they do, they forced DeepSeek to innovate around some of the limitations, for example, of its access to most advanced hardware.
And so, as we talked about last time, the restrictions seem to have accelerated China's drive, which I'm sure was in motion anyway, but have accelerated the drive to develop an indigenous chip making.
Absolutely.
So what leverage we have now will expire sooner by virtue of the chip war.
DeepSeek, one of the big takeaways here is, okay, we still don't know exactly, for example, how many GPUs they used or they had access to. In the paper that I mentioned earlier, the V3 paper, they said that the specific training run they did, sort of the final training run, was on a cluster of 2048 H800 GPUs, which are the ones that NVIDIA had to modify to meet the export controls that were put in place in October 2022. So they had access to those legally, right? They bought them, and then in October 2023, Commerce changed the threshold, and so those then after October 2023 were illegal to export to China. But when they bought them, they were legal, and then NVIDIA actually issued a statement that said that DeepSeek was leveraging widely available models and compute that is fully export control compliant, because at the same time as that paper came out, there's been speculation that happened in, I think Daria Amadei repeated this in the CEO of Scale AI, Alexander Wang, and Davos said this, that DeepSeek really has access to 50,000 H100 GPUs, which are export controlled and were export controlled from the very beginning.
Is there any basis for that speculation?
There is, as far as I've done extensive discussions with people around this. It's impossible to say for sure one way or another, but to me, the overwhelming sort of analysis of an understanding the company, suggests that is just been made up, right? Because there was an attempt to say, well, now, how much would that cost? These are very expensive GPUs. So the company, the DeepSeek, would have had a capex of something like $1.3 billion to have such a cluster. And NVIDIA is not aware of it. And it's hard to believe that NVIDIA wouldn't be aware of a cluster of 50,000 GPUs. Plus, if you look at what DeepSeek has focused on, it was optimizing those H800s in that cluster. That's one of the big things that came out of the paper. So if they had 50,000 H100s, why would they have focused so much attention on optimizing the hardware that they listed in that paper? So it's to me, I haven't been able to find any evidence. And the fact that NVIDIA said this, issued the statement that said that they were leveraging widely available models and compute that is fully export control compliant, that suggests to me that at least NVIDIA is certainly not aware of a secret 50,000 H100 cluster. So,
and I would add, the person that made that speculation about NVIDIA having the secret cache also, as I understand it, this is the CEO of Scale AI, right? He took out a full page ad in the Washington Post after the DeepSeek thing broke that said, "Dear President Trump, America must win the AI war," which again is a great talking point if you're running an American AI company, because then Trump will give you, various blessings, cut the regulatory hurdles to this, give you subsidies for that, and so on. Not that necessarily colored his motivation, but it's not impossible in this fallen world that we live in. So listen, if you can stick around a little, I would like to go into overtime, which is available to paid subscribers.
We should talk a little bit about what DeepSeek will be doing in the future in terms of what hardware they're going to be using to do training and inference. I think that's important too.
Plus, I want to ask you about what are the ways you use four different AI models every day. I think I could up my productivity. So this is available to paid subscribers for the Non-Zero newsletter. You can become one by going to Substack. Then you can set up a podcast feed that'll always have the overtime segments in them. But you should also, while you're at Substack, subscribe to Paul's newsletter, AI Stack Decrypted. Anything else you want to plug before we go into overtime, Paul?
No, I'm gonna be putting up another edition, which will look more hard, take a harder look at the GPU issue and access to GPUs and what that means, and try to get at the training versus inference issue.
And tomorrow is the day by the time this is posted. Thursday is the day that this will go up and your piece will go up. Okay, so thanks everybody for listening so far, and we are heading into overtime.